Acts 19 continues to recount Paul's ministry in Ephesus during his third missionary journey. We know from verse 10 that he was there at least 2 years. Last time we read about powerful works of healing and exorcism that the Lord did through Paul that led many converts to burn their books relating to magic that they had previously practiced. Verse 20 gave an encouraging summary of the impact this all had. So the word of the Lord grew mightily and prevailed. As we have seen before, evangelistic success can lead to threats, suffering, and persecution. And the rest of chapter 19 will show things headed that way in Ephesus before being curtailed by civic authorities. We're going to follow a simple two-part outline. First of all, looking at Paul's travel plans in verses 21 through 22. That will be rather brief. And then we'll look at the account of rioting in Ephesus in verses 23 through 41. And through this narrative, I think we're going to be able to reflect upon some aspects of the true nature of the gospel. Paul's travel plans, verse 21. When these things were accomplished, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, "After I have been there, I must also see Rome." When these things were accomplished suggests that this was sort of nearing the end of Paul's time in Ephesus. And we're told that he purposed in the Spirit to make certain travels. Paul here in some way is following the leading of the Holy Spirit as he maps out his future plans. And here the plans have three stages. We read first of all that he plans to pass through Macedonia and Achaia. Now if you'll turn over your bulletin once again and look at the back. He's in Ephesus, which is almost in the very center of the map, a little bit to the left. If you look to the left of that across the sea, you'll see Macedonia and Achaia. So Paul had traveled there before, and he plans to go back there, likely visiting those who had received his ministry before, checking on the churches, seeing how they are doing, and also, as we'll find out later on, gathering a collection for needy saints in Jerusalem. That's the first stage. He plans to go through Macedonia and Achaia and then to go to Jerusalem, which would be a long way. If he would sail, most likely he would go across much of the Mediterranean to get back to Jerusalem. We'll see that he's going to deliver special offerings there. And then he writes, "After I've been there, I must also see Rome." And if you look at your map, you'll see Paul has traveled broadly in this Mediterranean region and the region of Asia, but Rome lies to the north and the west of where this map is. And his desire is to go to Rome, and we know he ultimately wants to go to Spain. He wants to reach a part of the empire he has not yet done. And he says, "I must also see Rome," which suggests he felt a divine compulsion to do this. This is something I have to do. Well, verse 22, "So he sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, but he himself stayed in Asia for a time." Now we've met Timothy. He has been a traveling companion on Paul since early in his second missionary journey. We've never heard before about Erastus. His mention here reminds us that Paul's traveling band was included some people who are not always mentioned by name. Some of them that we'll meet later may have come just for a portion of the journey, but Erastus was one who was with him, and he sends him along with Timothy to Macedonia in advance of his own planned visit, perhaps to begin gathering that collection that he wants to take to Jerusalem and letting the Christians there know that Paul should be there soon. So before we finish with his ministry in Ephesus, we have a glimpse of his future plans. But he himself stayed in Asia for a time. He remains here in Ephesus. And that brings us to the bulk of our narrative, which describes the rioting in Ephesus in verses 23 through 41. We read in verse 23, "And about that time, there arose a great commotion about the way." Now, we first heard Christians referred to as the way back in chapter 9, which was before Paul's conversion. We read of him there, "Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem." The one-time persecutor of the way, when his name was Saul, has become its participant and promoter with his name of Paul. And as we said before, the significance of this designation, the way, is that it referred to Christianity considered as a way of thinking, living, and salvation. Now, if Christianity had just been one of many philosophical or religious systems in the empire, merely a matter of a certain beliefs that you would give mental assent to, it would not have been a threat to the status quo in Ephesus. But you see, Christianity is meant to be applied. And it is this application in a particular sphere that was the reason that there arose a great commotion about the way in Ephesus. And we quickly learn the root of the commotion. We read in verses 24 through 27, "For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. He called them together with the workers of similar occupation and said, 'Men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade. Moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshiped.'" Now, when we encountered Paul in Ephesus earlier, we remarked that the temple to Diana, also known as Artemis, was considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was a destination for many tourists or for those who wanted to pay her religious devotion. And just as tourist spots today have souvenir shops, there was a thriving business of selling temple-related wares to visitors in Ephesus. And we know from archaeological digs in various parts of the Roman Empire that little models, little replicas of the temple, traveled far and wide as people went to Ephesus and then went back to their homes. So this was a well-known place, a well-visited place. And that thing, either a small replica of the temple or some figure of Diana herself, was the kind of devotional souvenir that Demetrius and others crafted and sold. In the case of Demetrius, he was a silversmith, so his were made of silver. And the key point here is that these products brought no small profit to the craftsmen. So to his credit, Demetrius is upfront about the financial impact Paul's ministry is having on the Ephesian craftsmen. "Men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade. Moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul is persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship." We want to break down this speech and look at it sort of section by section. First of all, "Men, you know that we have prosperity by this trade." By mentioning that first, it seems that Demetrius' primary concern is likely financial. And he addresses his fellow craftsmen who would share concern in this regard. They made their money through trade to tourists who came to Ephesus because the temple was there. If anything were to diminish that travel, their trade would be stunted and they would not make the money they were used to making. So first of all, they're concerned about their prosperity. And then he says, "Moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands." Now, Paul has been in Ephesus, probably at this point, around 2 years. They know about Paul's ministry here, but note that they also know that he has ministered throughout Asia, and he's been preaching the same message. The gospel is going forth in power. And part of Paul's message is that gods made by hands are not true gods. Now, in this, he is simply applying to the current scene what was taught in the Old Testament. For example, we read in Psalm 135, "The idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. nor is there any breath in their mouths. Those who make them are like them, so is everyone who trusts in them. And if Demetrius or his fellow craftsmen were to craft an idol of Diana, this would be true. She would have a mouth, she wouldn't speak. She'd have eyes, but she couldn't see. She'd have ears, but she couldn't hear. There was no breath in her mouth. And of course, the suggestion in the psalm is that those who make them are like them. Needless to say, this is not a message that would sit well with those who made a living from crafting and selling idols. Now, Demetrius then links his financial concerns with the reputation of their temple and goddess. So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship. So he might be able to reach some craftsmen about concern for their bank accounts, but there may have been others who were likely true devotees of Diana, who saw their trade as an act of piety, as creating things that could help others in their religious devotion. They might well be moved to action by Demetrius' statement that as a result of Paul's preaching, the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed. And he closes with a reminder that it is Diana and her temple that has put Ephesus on the map, for she is the goddess whom all Asia and the world worship. And again, we have archaeological evidence that that was true, that people from around the empire engaged in worship of the goddess Diana. So, we see Demetrius appeal both to the pocketbook and the piety of his fellow craftsmen. And in this, he's successful. Verse 28. Now, when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." So Demetrius' appeal here really stirred them up. They're filled with anger, with wrath, and they cry out with this statement to their goddess, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." I think that last phrase, "of the Ephesians," is telling. These men of Ephesus saw their city as having some kind of special claim on the goddess. At bottom, they probably really thought, "Great is Ephesus. Yes, we have the temple, but doesn't that make us great?" Well, the angry cries spread until the city was in an uproar. Verse 29. So the whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater with one accord, having seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, Paul's travel companions. So confusion and chaos take over. Now it is not just the craftsmen, but the whole city, and they begin to act like a mob. And while they probably wish to get to Paul, they apparently don't know where he is. They can't reach him, and so they seize two of his traveling companions, Gaius and Aristarchus. We're told that they're from Macedonia, so it's quite possible that they are ones that he had ministered to before when he had been in that region. And here we meet again some of Paul's companions who had not been previously named. We'll see them both mentioned later on, so they do continue to travel with the apostle. And we're told that the whole city rushed into the theater with one accord, taking Gaius and Aristarchus with them. Now, this is the great amphitheater of Ephesus. It seated 24,000 people. It is still standing today. If you go to Ephesus, you can see this great amphitheater. And it seems that what they try to do is convene an emergency assembly of the citizens of Ephesus. Well, the word obviously is spreading throughout all the city, so Paul hears about it. We read in verse 30, and when Paul wanted to go into the people, the disciples would not allow him. Of course, this is what we expect the apostle to do. Here's a great audience, and they're concerned about him. Let him go in and let him preach and defend the gospel. But the disciples were concerned for his safety. They would not allow him to go in. And perhaps surprisingly, they're not the only ones concerned about this. Verse 31, then some of the officials of Asia, who were his friends, sent to him pleading that he would not venture into the theater. And we're not told specifically who these officials in Asia were. They could be civic leaders or cultic leaders or a mix of both. Some of them may have been Christians, but likely they weren't all, but somehow they had come to have respect for Paul, a certain amount of friendship with Paul, and so they pleaded along with his disciples that he not take the risk of entering the amphitheater. And apparently they were successful, because we don't read of Paul going in. Meanwhile, inside that theater, the scene is truly chaotic. Verse 32. Some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Now, this is very typical mob behavior. People hear an uproar, they join the crowd, they add their voices to the uproar, even if they don't know what the gathering is all about. And we've seen this happen recently when there's various protests in cities. There might be some stated cause for the protest, but others join in and get into the mayhem and take advantage of it to engage in criminal activity. It's the kind of thing that shows us that there's nothing new under the sun. And with all this happening, it's understandable to read that the assembly was confused. So some try to bring order to the crowd. Verse 33, and they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander motioned with his hands and wanted to make his defense to the people. Now, we're not sure why these Jews put forward Alexander. In fact, we're not sure whether he was a Jewish Christian, in which case he would want to be making a defense of Paul and his ministry, or perhaps he was one of the unbelieving Jews that had been successful in kicking Paul out of the synagogue and would want to make the point that these Christians are not Jews at all and therefore be defending his territory against this upstart religion. Whatever the case, we don't get to hear from him. Because we read in verse 34, but when they found out that he was a Jew, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." You see, this crowd is not interested in anyone who does not join them in devotion to Diana. And the Jews were known for not joining in with the various religions of the empire. So shutting Alexander down, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Can you imagine being there? Imagine the scene. All the crowd repeating the same phrase over and over for 2 hours. "Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is Diana of the Ephesians." It's like a little revival among the devotees of Diana seems to be breaking out. But finally, someone with authority intervenes. Verse 35. And when the city clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple guardian of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Zeus?" So the city official, he quiets the crowd, and he begins his appeal to them by confirming their zeal for Diana and her temple. And he reminds them that everybody knows the special status of Ephesus as the guardian of the temple of the goddess, and also of the image which fell down from Zeus. And this is likely a reference to a meteorite. We have references to other temples at times when meteorites fell from the sky and landed on the earth. They were considered to be sent by the gods, and they were revered, and they were often placed in temples. So it seems that that is what has happened here in Ephesus. But having taken their side, as it were, in matters religious, the clerk continues, verse 36, "Therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly." So he tells them, look, the reputation of Diana and her temple are secure. You don't need to worry about that, so there's no reason to be in an uproar. You don't want to do something rash that you're going to later regret. Verse 37, "For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess." So he suggests, well, it would be one thing if you caught these guys robbing the temple, but they haven't done that. And he also says they're not blasphemers of your goddess. Now, that seems very unlikely to be true, since the implication of the gospel preached by Paul and his associates would certainly be considered blasphemy by the devotees of Diana. His point might be simply that they had not heard Gaius and Aristarchus speak directly against the goddess. Perhaps there was no one who could say, "I heard him say exactly that." We're not sure, but verse 38, he continues, "Therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anyone, the courts are open, and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another." So seeking to maintain peace and order, the city official points out that there is an appropriate procedure if you want to bring charges against someone. The courts are open. There are proconsuls. Mob violence is not an acceptable alternative to official justice, and they are welcome to seek the latter through the courts. And then he adds in verse 39, "But if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined in the lawful assembly." what Demetrius had instituted was an unlawful assembly. We know from inscriptions that Ephesus had a formal legal assembly of municipal citizens once a month. And so they could go at the normal time and they could raise their concerns there. Then he points out what may have been his primary concern, and that was the danger the crowd brought to the city. Verse 40, "For we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar, there being no reason which we may give to account for this disorderly gathering." You see, Ephesus was a free city. It had special privileges in the empire. The Roman consul could call the city's officials together and ask them to defend what has happened here, and they would have no grounds to do so. They could risk losing some of the civic freedoms that were granted by Rome. And it seems his argument is effective, for we read in verse 41, "And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly." So he was able to restore peace. He was able to dismiss the crowd. Gaius and Aristarchus are saved from harm, and the city of Ephesus is saved from possible problems with Rome. And Paul, whose preaching has been the root of all this mayhem, has not said a single word in this episode. In a sense, it's all about Paul, but he doesn't speak here, as he has spoken often. When we reflect on this narrative, I want to suggest that Demetrius had a better understanding of the implications of the Christian gospel than did the city official in Ephesus. And that is because Christianity is transformative. We saw that earlier in this chapter, when converts to Christianity who had practiced magic brought their magic books and burned them in the fire, even though they were worth a tremendous amount of money. They recognized that their new faith meant a change in their behavior, and they evidenced their repentance by this act of burning the books of magic. The way is a good designation for our faith, because our faith does aim to transform all of life. It is not only a list of doctrines, it is, in light of those things that we believe, this is the way that we live. And I think that is an application we can draw from the passage. The gospel is not, say the sinner's prayer, walk the aisle, and you're assured of heaven. Meanwhile, you can live however you want. No, God's plan is to conform each believer to the image of his Son, Jesus. And as Paul tells us in Ephesians, that means putting off sin and putting on righteousness. And for any in Ephesus, it would surely mean rejecting the worship of Diana and reserving worship for the one true triune God. Dietrich Bonhoeffer warned about what he called cheap grace. It is true that salvation is a free gift, but it is costly in its demands for our daily living. Listen to the words of Jesus as he speaks about this in Luke 14. "Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciples. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest, after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." Jesus told the multitudes, and we've been seeing this in our morning study of Mark, he told them to count the cost before committing to being his disciple. The fact is that he must take priority in your life over everything else, even over good things like family. It's not that we literally hate our family, but our love for Jesus is so great that we cannot follow our family if they would lead us in a way that he would not have us go. That being a disciple means being called to carry a cross, an instrument of capital punishment in that day. It means being willing to forsake all to follow Jesus. You see, Demetrius was right in his fear that mass conversion to Christianity would ruin his business and bring disrepute to the goddess of Diana. And ultimately in history, it did. I doubt that there are any more Diana worshipers around the world today, although I don't know, with the internet, somebody's probably got a website about it, and there probably are a little pocket somewhere. But the fact is, the gospel has triumphed. That old religion is gone. But it is a shame that many in the church today are more like the city official in Ephesus than Demetrius. They see Christianity as a get-out-of-hell free card, without understanding the radical call of discipleship that is as countercultural today as it was in Ephesus when Paul was preaching there. So let us not make that mistake, but offer our all to Jesus, knowing that the way of the cross is still the way to eternal blessing.